In a world where hope is scarce and resources are limited, one man's journey will change the course of humanity. He's a warrior, a protector, and a guardian of the last remaining artifact that holds the key to our future. He is a man with a book, and that book is the Bible. Hi, my name is Matt Jarbo. Welcome back to another episode of Podio Commentary. I think this is episode number 25, actually. I do apologize for the late delay in getting the episode out, just life got in the way. These things tend to happen sometimes when you have kids, especially a three-year-old and a five-year-old, both in preschool. It just happens all the time. But today I want to talk about a movie that came out January 15th, 2010. That, of course, is The Book of Eli. This movie, I think, really holds up. I just watched it again the other night to prepare for the episode, and I have to say that for as simplistic as it is, it does convey a lot of very interesting themes, a lot of interesting meanings. And one of the things I really enjoy is the concept of faith and holding true to your faith, as well as the fact that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And people who want to wield words for positivity and those who want to wield them for control. It's just an interesting concept that also makes me really think, like, if we were going to apply this to video games, I would say this is like the closest thing we've had from a major studio release that feels like a Fallout game than anything else. And I'm even talking about Mad Max Fury Road in that one, because that one also was turned into a video game that came out a few months after its release in 2015. By the way, that game is great. If you haven't played it, go check it out. Also, go watch the movie, which we'll be talking about here on the show at some point in time. But The Book of Eli feels very much like a game that would have come out around that time, which is actually a little bit before Fallout New Vegas came out in 2011. And part of me is curious if in any way the development of that game might have been somewhat influenced by this movie. And so over the course of this episode, we are going to be talking about the film itself, how it came to be, the writer, the director, all that stuff, as well as my thoughts on the overall movie and talking about its legacy, as well as its critical response, its box office, its home video, and even a little interesting bit involving some legal troubles that the movie's writer got into, a little bit of that no-no copyright violation stuff. But before we dive into that, I'd just like to remind everybody, if you're listening to this, wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, please do what you can to leave a review, to like where you can, to subscribe, tell your friends. And of course, if you want to find me on Twitter at Podio Commentary, it is a great way to connect with me and maybe let me know a movie you want me to talk about down the road. And if you want to make sure I do talk about a very specific movie, you can always head on over to patreon.com/Matt Jarbo, M-A-T-T-J-A-R-B-O. And you can sign up there to get yourself a movie of your choice with the perk that's available. So thank you guys for that. I really appreciate that. So let's talk about The Book of Eli. This is a post-apocalyptic film set in a world that has been devastated by a nuclear war. The story follows a man named Eli, played by Denzel Washington, who has been wandering the wasteland for 30 years, carrying with him a valuable book that he is tasked with protecting at all costs. As Eli travels west, he comes across a small town run by a ruthless man named Carnegie, played by Gary Oldman, who is desperate to get his hands on the book. Carnegie believes that the book holds the key to rebuilding society and establishing himself as its leader. Eli must use his combat skills and his deep faith to protect the book and continue on his journey, despite the many dangers he encounters along the way. I think the synopsis does a good job of just kind of setting up the idea. However, I do think there's a little bit of a misnomer in regards to the nuclear war. It's implied that there was a nuclear war. It's implied that the apocalypse was brought on by that, because there's a line in the movie about how the sky opened up and the sun came down and that's what wiped everybody out. But here's the thing. Radiation doesn't really seem to play a part in any of this. Eli was alive before the bombs fell. You know, even Solara's mother, Jennifer Beals, in the movie, she was alive before the bombs fell. There's no radiation. So instead of it really being a nuclear war, what we're kind of intended to believe, I think it was actually the rapture. I think it was the rapture, because while he's trying to get this book across the country, I'm assuming, he's been wandering for 30 years. It doesn't take you 30 years to walk across the country. It's only like 3,600 miles long. You'd hit it eventually. If you were walking 10 miles a day, you're looking at what, 360 days a year tops? I mean, it seems that there's a lot going on with everything in regards to this to really kind of make you question how certain things kind of came to be in the movie. But I actually feel it had more to do with a rapture or a biblical act versus a nuclear war, because as Carnegie describes how he's been looking for the book ever since the war happened, people found the book, burned the book en masse, and this is the last copy that's available. So why would they turn to the Bible, destroy the Bible, unless it was something that was predicted potentially in the Bible? And that is something that the movie leaves to your interpretation, but I don't want to get too far ahead of myself on this one. So let's talk about the writer and the director of the movie. I always like diving into this particular topic because it's always cool to see what else these guys have done. Now, the movie was written by Gary Whitta and directed by the Hughes brothers. Gary Whitta is actually a British screenwriter, author, and journalist who has actually written a number of notable films and video games like The Walking Dead Telltale series, which is really fantastic. He worked on Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, which, you know, if you've seen it, you know how good it is. However, I will say I don't know how much of what was in the final cut was written by Tony Gilroy, who we know came in to kind of like oversee things. And if you happen to take a look at the Andor TV show on Disney Plus, it's so well written. I don't know how much Gary Whitta had to do with what we saw final, but I'm not going to admonish the guy. I think he is a good writer, and I think he did a lot of really good work on this movie. Now, the director of the film was the Hughes brothers, Albert and Alan Hughes, who are identical twin brothers who have been working together since the 1990s. They're actually best known for their films Menace to Society and Dead Presidents, movies about the inner city, and very interesting, very, you know, like stark in contrast to this particular film. But one thing I think really kind of overlays between both those kind of movies and this is that there is a penchant for violence, and the violence is more about survival rather than it is maybe like hedonistic, if that's the word I want to use here. Like in Menace to Society and Dead Presidents, there's a lot of violence in those movies, but they kind of seem to serve a purpose. In The Book of Eli, there's a lot of violence in the movie because there's a lot of violence in the world, but it's done in a way that seems more as being a necessity rather than being something that is like exploitative and meant to be strictly for enjoyment. So when it came to writing the screenplay for the movie, Gary Whitta actually came up with the idea back in 2007 after writing several smaller screenplays, as well as tackling rewrites and punch-ups for other movies. He really wanted to work on something original, and that's actually how he described it. He says, "It originally started with very pulpy roots. I grew up on movies like The Man with No Name, A Fistful of Dollars, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. I've always loved the idea of that kind of lone, wandering hero. I grew up on The Seven Samurai. To some extent, there's a little Obi-Wan Kenobi in there as well, because Star Wars, to some extent, was inspired by Westerns and old samurai movies. There is something, I think, very mythic about the idea of that kind of nomadic character, that kind of lone wanderer, warrior, prophet." Now, Joel Silver eventually got his hands on the screenplay, was excited by it, and took it to Warner Brothers in 2007. After that, the Hughes brothers signed on, and they finally were able to lock down Denzel Washington for the role. But when it came time for Warner Brothers to pony up that $80 million check for the movie, they got cold feet. Which, this is Warner Brothers in 2008, 2009. They were still sitting pretty. This isn't Warner Brothers of today. If this was Warner Brothers of like the 2020s, I'd be like, oh yeah, completely understandable. It's bad over there right now. They are in desperate rebuild mode. But back then, they had a really significant stake in the market. I actually would argue at the time, they were the number one studio in Hollywood. They had the most market share. I was working at a drive-in. I'll mention that occasionally that they're at the podcast. But we would get every Warner Brothers movie that came along, every single one. It didn't matter because we had a really good working relationship with them, and they would release one or two a month. They would always be putting out movies. So $80 million seems like something back then at almost what could be the height of the DVD market, and all of that money that was coming in through the ancillary marketplace. Getting cold feet seems kind of dumb, but Gary Whitta actually describes it like this. He says, it's actually an independent film. Warners had the opportunity to make the film right up until the last minute, and he went to greenlight the movie, where the head of the studio decides whether or not he's going to make the film, and they ultimately said no. And this is with Denzel attached and the directors, the whole package. The movie was basically ready to go, and the studio said, we're kind of having cold feet. We don't want to do it now. So they said no. We went back to square one, and we thought the movie was dead. What happened was a company called Alcon, which at the time had just had a big hit with The Blind Side, the movie with Sandra Bullock where she adopts a football player, and they were looking for this kind of material. They basically came in and wrote the check themselves, and basically funded the whole movie outside of the studio system. Warner Brothers still distributed the film, but it wasn't made as a studio movie. And that was actually terrific for us because it meant that once we were given the budget, we basically had creative freedom to make the movie that we wanted. The studio notes kind of went away because there was no studio. What we originally thought was death of the project, which was Warner Brothers saying no to financing it, actually eventually helped us. We got to make the movie essentially as an independent film without anything like the typical kind of studio development process that you might see a big movie like that go through. To kind of summarize everything, Whitta said this. I wrote it in late 2006. We sold it to Warner Brothers in early 2007. It was in theaters January 2010. So from beginning to end, it was a little over 3 years, which might sound like a long time, but by movie standards, it's actually staggeringly fast. He's not wrong. He's really not wrong. They actually shot the movie relatively quickly, and they got it in theaters pretty quick. And the movie had, I would argue, a pretty decent impact at the time. It was pretty highly anticipated, at least in my neck of the woods. Here you had a post-apocalyptic movie starring Denzel Washington as a lone wanderer through the apocalyptic desert. This is like 2 years after Fallout 3. So there'd been this kind of resurgence of this kind of stuff that had been going on. A lot of that type of mindset was there. People liked that kind of stuff. And it just seemed like such a really cool, highly stylized film. Now, when you start breaking down the nitty-gritty of it, it gets interesting because you start talking about like the concept of faith and the power that faith has over people, especially like, you know, dogmatic teachings have over people and everything that's happened as a result of those kind of teachings. I know like Carnegie in the movie wants to control people by having that. He wants to rebuild cities and nations in his image by using the last copy of that book as a way to wield that power. He believes in his mind that he won't have to use violence as a cudgel, that he'll be able to use the text as a way to inspire people to work on his behalf. But the truth of the matter is he would burn the witch. Let's be fair. There'd be a lot more killings, but he would do that in the name of this book that would then allow him to have that kind of absolute control. All right, let's talk about the movie itself, because I always felt that the intro to the movie was completely separate from everything else we got in the film. In the opening shot of the movie, you see a person who has been shot and killed, and he is not wearing shoes, which is a typical thing for Eli as we go through the film. But the camera starts tracking by this guy as we see a forest that appears to have been on fire. It gives a visual like this is a nuclear fallout. Like there is radiation here. We see Eli wearing a gas mask while prepping a bow and arrow as a cat comes into frame, and he ends up killing the cat. And then he bags the cat, which if there's been so much freaking radiation, then, I mean, the cat was hairless. So that's obviously what they're implying, you know, that the cat somehow went through chemo, I guess. Like, these are all visual cues to give you an idea of just where the world is. But immediately following that, we see him just kind of walking through the wasteland. There's no forest. There's no trees. There's no fallout. It's like a completely different biome. And I understand it's meant to convey that he's been walking for all this time. And I understand that. But of course, as he enters into the first encounter in the movie, we get to see the woman crying out for help. He wants to help her. And then all the other guys show up. They try to rob him. He brutally slays them all in a really, really, really excellent scene. What I love about that scene is that it conveys that, for one, this movie is violent. He will dismember people because he'll tell him he's going to do it, which I thought was great. But not only that, the way that the Hughes brothers shot that sequence was like one take, from the looks of it, one take, highly choreographed, obviously, but shot in the silhouette of the overpass. And it gives this real interesting graphic novel approach to the movie that I know it's not based on a graphic novel. It's not trying to be a comic book adaptation, but it still really feels like it in this specific sense, or something you might see in a video game, or it just kind of has that weird kind of visceral look to it that feels like you would get it in alternative media rather than in a movie like this. And of course, after dispatching his foes, he ends up leaving the water for the woman, keeps on his way. And then he ends up coming across another group of people who are being attacked by these raiders. And he literally just stands there as this woman is getting, like, she's getting assaulted, right? She's getting assaulted, and then they do their business, and then they kill her. After they shot her husband dead or her partner dead or whatever. And he's just like, stay the path, stay the path, stay the path. And you're like, that's weird, because like, you just murdered all those guys. So you clearly have the ability to step in and save somebody. But instead, he's choosing to not do that. He's choosing to stay the path. And I always thought that was kind of odd, because everything else he's done in the movie, you know, I know it's meant to be like, I don't want to say some kind of like moral ambiguity, but everything else he's done in the movie after that point makes him out to be, you know, a saint, if you will. Like, he will help those who need it. But in the moment here, he just chose not to. Now, that could be because he realized that they had guns, and they were a lot more of them. They were a lot more organized than the other group of people. And even that was more of a direct self-defense moment versus a moment where he would have then been the aggressor. And perhaps that's the way that he morally justifies all of the people he has murdered, not only in this movie, but probably well before then. And I find that to be kind of interesting, because there's a line at the end of the movie where he's praying to God, and he's like, I'd like to say I'm sorry for all the bad stuff that I've done too. But like, it's all kind of nonchalant. He's like, look, you told me to go west. I went west. I listened to you. You protected me. I also murdered a bunch of people. So, you know, like, sorry I killed your flock, but they were in my way. You know, I guess what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Collateral damage. You know, cue the Arnold Schwarzenegger collateral damage line. You want collateral damage? I'll give you effing collateral. I can't even do the Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm not going to do it. But of course, after that, he walks into town, and the town is run by Carnegie. He goes to get his iPod charged, which, let's be fair, that movie, like, the fact that he had an iPod absolutely, like, dates when that movie came out. Very similar to how in, like, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, when, you know, Quill gets a Zoom at the end of the movie, or a Zune, right? And you're like, oh, wow, that's totally, like, kind of dating what this stuff is supposed to be. I always thought that was kind of interesting. I thought that was pretty funny. But anyway, as he is killing time, he decides to go into the bar to get something to drink, ends up getting accosted by the same raiders that he had witnessed kill that woman and her boyfriend outside of town. And he ends up, you know, killing one guy by bashing his head into the bar, breaking his nose, maybe driving the nose bone into the brain. I think that's probably what it is. And then again, we get another really cool stylized action scene that he's just murdering everybody. Not even a scratch, not even a problem, barely an inconvenience, to quote Ryan George. And from here, Carnegie catches on that something's going on, and he realizes that Eli is a force to be reckoned with, and one that could be good for him. But as all, you know, heroes and villains interact with one another, you know, you're going to have an unstoppable force meets an immovable object. And that's, of course, the catalyst for their particular encounter. But they still are able to get him to stay overnight. He realizes that he's got to kind of stay with them or else they might hurt him, which is kind of funny because he literally just took out like 10 of these guys without even a care, without a problem. So he's like, yeah, I'll hang out. But that actually kind of like adds to a very interesting thought that comes towards the end of the movie, which I'll get to when talking about the fallout of everything. And so it's here that he meets Solara, played by Mila Kunis, which let me just like say, I've always enjoyed Mila Kunis, you know, grew up watching that 70s show. I always feel like they cast her in these roles that are just not for her. She was fine here. A little out of place, a little bit too clean, if you will. I know that sounds kind of weird considering it's a post-apocalyptic world that she grew up in, yet she's still magically like not as dirty and really well put together as everybody else. Well, she is kind of like the scullery maid of a whorehouse. It's just a little bit, you know, a little bit on the unbelievable side of things. And her mom, it's also because her mom is the girlfriend to Carnegie. So you get a little bit of that there as well. There's a bit of favoritism, if you will. But then you also go back, I think like the year or two before, and she was in Max Payne and playing Mona Sachs, like the mafia hitwoman that Max has a romantic entanglement with. And as much as I enjoy that movie for what it is, and I'll do an episode on that movie, that to me was something that was like completely miscast. And I'm not even talking Mark Wahlberg as Max Payne. I mean, Mila Kunis as Mona Sachs was just like, okay. And that's something that happens with her quite a bit around that time. I feel like she was enough of a hot commodity where they needed to put her, they wanted to put her in movies because she could probably sell tickets. And maybe she wanted to go darker and grittier as a way to kind of get away from like the Jackie persona. But it just kind of seems a little bit odd, if I'm being honest with you. Not to say it's bad, just a little bit on the odd side. Anyway, back to the story. So as Eli is escaping, is trying to get out of the town, Carnegie and him get in this massive shootout after he refuses Carnegie's, Carnegie's invitation to join his party. But he has to give him the book because Carnegie understands that he now has a Bible, but he also like understands that he needs it. This is what he's been looking for, and he will do anything and everything and sacrifice it all to get his hands on the book. And during the shootout, I mean, Eli is taking like shots are hitting him in the backpack. Nothing's impacting him. He's one-shotting like almost like 360 no-scoping all of these bad guys. And at one point he runs out of ammo, ducks behind a car, pulls out a shotgun, fires off a round at one guy. And it part of that buckshot hits Carnegie in the leg. And this is the first time that like people are kind of watching their god bleed and that there might be a potential lack of respect going forward. It's not to say that it really happens, but when you, it's like in 300, when they get that one injury against Xerxes, right? The one throw of the spear and it slightly gashes his cheek. That is watching God bleed. And when we talk about these people that are larger than life, that some out there, these dictators, if you will, that have been able to like almost establish themselves as godly characters, infallible, untouchable. When you can make them bleed, it's almost worse than just killing them outright. Because if you kill them outright, they become a martyr. Then their followers will usually stick harder to their resolve as a result of that. But in this particular case, wounding him causes him to lose power because they show that he is not infallible, that he is in fact a person who can be hurt. And that's something that I think comes into play later on. After the fight with Carnegie's men, Eli ends up taking off. Solara tags along with him, trying to get him to take her to wherever he's going for safety and protection. He denies her, as he will in every one of these scenarios, because he's been alone for all this time. So he doesn't want to have anyone else's responsibility. I think part of it, too, is that the voice in his head that is driving him to do this is probably like telling him, like, just ignore them. Like that woman before when he says like, just stay the path, just stay the path. We have to ask ourselves, is he doing that because he is afraid or is he doing that because the voice in his head, the voice that is supposedly the word of God, probably coming in through the Metatron, if I'm being honest with you, if that is something that he's being told in that moment, because he tends to do that with Solara by locking her away where they get their water, and then she ends up getting out. She's trying to track Eli, almost ends up getting sexually assaulted. Eli then comes back, kills those two guys, and then takes her with him. And it's here that they're trying to outrun Carnegie and his men, who are trying to frantically find them before the sun goes down because they don't want to lose them in the darkness. And it's here during the night scene where we get a bit more story about what's going on with Eli. And he talks about how he's been walking for 30 years and how he hears this voice. And Solara, you can tell, doesn't really believe him at first. She's trying to understand it. I mean, she knows he has skills. She knows he's protected. She's seen it. She's witnessed it. She knows there's something special about him. But she still wants to see what's in the book. She absolutely wants to see it for herself. And it's the temptation part of that, I think, that's really fascinating. Because he, you know, admonishes her for it. And he chides her for not being able to read, so she wouldn't understand it anyway. So then she asks him to teach her, which I thought was interesting because it's here that there would be the first sense of a real rebellion, right? Because oftentimes when you deal with a dictator, denying them education, denying access to the written word, denying access to knowledge is usually the first course of, ways to kind of keep people under control. And I don't want to like wax political too much with this, but if you've been paying attention to what's going on in Florida right now, it kind of runs a little bit on the parallel side of that. We really do see people who fashion themselves as being those in power who want to maintain that power, to hold on to it, you know, irregardless of anything that might happen. When you start to restrict access to knowledge, that is where you gain that power. But as soon as people have the ability to learn and they have the ability to read and understand, that power starts to diminish. And that's really what Carnegie wants. So here with Solara asking, can you teach me to read? I interpreted that as being very much like a really, you know, like the kind of the start of her journey on that front, right? Of like what she needs to do to try to help people. And that does kind of tie in, I think, to the end of the movie, because like it kicks off and goes to the next day. The two of them are wandering. They come across a house. They decide to go check the house. And this is where they meet the crazies, George and Martha, who have been living out there alone for 30 plus years in the apocalyptic wasteland. And they are very resourceful. And as we come to find out very quickly, they're cannibals who kill people, eat people, and they got the crazy fingers as a result of that. And that's when, of course, the bad guys show up and it turns the entire set into a massive shootout. And I will say, like, I love the way that this scene plays out because, you've got George, Martha with their plethora of guns. You've got Eli and you've got Solara and they're talking and Solara's all like, well, what's the voice telling you? And Eli goes, oh, the voice is telling me that, you know, we'll get out alive. And then George goes, well, what about us? And he goes, yeah, not you guys. And then, of course, minutes later, they're both dead. And it's just, it's kind of just funny how that works out. But again, it's kind of leading to the concept. It's leaning heavily into the idea that Eli is telling the truth. And I think as an audience, as we're watching this movie play out, we have to ask ourselves, because again, I'm like atheist / agnostic sort of thing, right? So I don't really put a lot of faith in a higher power necessarily, but like, again, we as an audience are meant to question, is Eli telling the truth or is Eli insane? And as the movie progresses and we watch him literally just like dodge bullets almost in real time, bullets fire at him, but they don't impact him. It ends up being a situation where you start to look, well, maybe he does have the protection of Christ or some kind of equivalent. A benevolent being of some kind is looking after him. And in that moment when he says, we're going to get out of this alive, and the other two don't make it, and they actually do make it, it kind of leads you to believe that. And then, of course, they get captured. and he ends up giving up the book as a way to save Solara. And when Carnegie gets the book, because Eli was tasked with him alone being the bearer of that book, and as soon as it goes into the enemy's hands, i.e. the devil's hands, the devil shoots him in the gut, leaves him for dead. Now, Eli decides to keep on with his mission, and he keeps going while Solara ends up getting away herself and going back to rescue him. Now, I have no basis of geography for this movie. I don't know where exactly they were at the beginning of this versus where they were at the end. Like, we know at the end they get to San Francisco. We know they head towards Alcatraz Island, and that's where they meet everybody, right? That's where they recite the book. But what I don't get is, like, how far that car made it with gas, because they clearly weren't that far away from the coast if they were able to make it there in, like, an afternoon. You know, that's what it feels like. Like, there's a suspension of disbelief on this. Like, gas is something that is very rare. We don't know how far he is from the coastline. They seem to make it pretty quickly. Carnegie ends up going back to the town. He's got the book. He's injured. And as he finally gets the book open and he realizes, and this is like one of the best like FUs in the movie, that the book was in Braille. Now, there's been some question as well based upon the portrayal of Eli through Denzel's performance, whether or not he was actually blind. But as we see him start to recite the King James Bible to the people inside the sanctuary, this would be Lombardi, played by Malcolm McDowell, which was great as a nice little cameo. We start to see him reciting Genesis, and the camera does this like slow zoom into his eyes as it kind of juxtaposes between the two scenes. And as it's happening, we start to kind of see the eyes gloss over a little bit, the eyes to become a bit more milky, indicating that he was blind. So in that moment, my inference on that is that he actually wasn't blind necessarily. It wasn't that he had the protection of an almighty being. It's that he really did have the ability to see, that God or whomever granted him that ability. And as he was completing his task of reciting the King James Bible verbatim, verse by verse, chapter by chapter, to the record keeper, that he is starting to lose his power because his mission is coming to an end, which is why as he is reciting the book, they end up like treating the wound. They end up like shaving off his beard, off his hair, and they present him in almost like ceremonial death robes, because as soon as he's done reciting the book, he himself passes away. Now, Carnegie, on the other hand, realizes in this moment that he's lost everything, that that all the men that he sacrificed, that his enforcers around town, all the men that he had working for him under his thumb, they're all dead, with the exception really of one. And everything is being torn apart. The brothel he owns is being torn apart. There's a bunch of assault that's happening. And the last remaining guy, and I just kind of love the way that we see this guy, and he sits down in the middle of the bar, and he just pulls out a shotgun, and he starts just kind of loading the shotgun, right? Putting shells, you know, loading, like kind of putting them in like the little, at the edge of the stock, there's like a little holder there. And you can see he's just like kind of loading his gun. And he looks at Carnegie, and Carnegie looks at him, and he just has this look like all is lost. And Carnegie also realizes at that point that all is lost. Now, I thought that guy was going to, like, you know, kill himself or do whatever, but you can tell he just doesn't know what to do. He thought he had purpose. Now his purpose is gone. Carnegie thought he had purpose, and now his purpose is gone. He's lost everything. He sacrificed it all because he wanted to get this book. He's got an injured leg that is starting to become infected, meaning he'll either have to amputate or he will die. And he has no one there to protect him. So when that mob gets done destroying the bar, drinking their fill, pillaging, and R-wording a lot of stuff, he's going to be next. But we as an audience don't see that, which I thought was really interesting. That we as an audience actually, like, don't see his death. We just know that it's imminent. But what we do see is him at his lowest, which I thought was really interesting. It's just that the regret that is on his face the last time we see Carnegie. But then we get like probably one of the weirder elements of how the movie ends. And that is Solara taking on the mantle of Eli, going back home to, I guess, help to probably find her mom. And again, it's just Mila Kunis walking the wasteland. And that's where the movie ends. But we do find out that the record keeper had also been able to get their hands on the Torah and the Quran and other religious texts, meaning that it's not just one religion like that's really going to protect the world, which goes back to my previous thought about it being more of a rapture rather than it being a nuclear war. And of course, that's all open for interpretation. You could have interpreted it differently than me, but I felt that by the end of the movie, they were trying to showcase that it's not just one religion or one faith that saves everybody, that it's really a combination of everything. And that's open for interpretation as well. But that being said, I really liked the movie quite a bit. And it turns out that critics actually pretty liked it as well. It did generally receive positive reviews from critics and audiences. Many of them praised the cast, the visuals, and the action scenes. The movie did ultimately gross $157 million at the worldwide box office, with another $63 million in home video sales, which essentially made it like a financial success. And it's not that this movie necessarily needs a sequel, but it is kind of experimental to an extent. It is an independent film overall. So you like to see this kind of stuff happen because you want to see more things like this. But like I said at the beginning, the movie wasn't without controversy. There was actually a little bit of a legal hiccup that happened in Australia, because you have an Australian filmmaker named Aaron Stevenson, who made the subtle or not so subtle accusations that Gary Whitta may have actually plagiarized Stevenson's 1998 movie Freedom Deep. Now, when confronted with these accusations, David Fearson, the director of business affairs and legal counsel at Alcon Entertainment, did make the following statement in an interview over the phone. He says, "This is the first time I'm hearing about this, and the first time anybody at Alcon has heard about this either. It would have been very difficult to acknowledge him, this being the director, if we hadn't heard about him before. I'll take a look and see what, if anything, on our behalf needs to be done. We certainly want to hear if there's an accusation, and if anything's been stolen for him, we want to hear that as well. We set out as any company to avoid alienating anybody's rights and property. And of course, here's the thing. Nothing ever came from that, as far as I can tell, and Gary Whitta himself has actually declined to comment. I thought about asking him about that myself while I was researching this movie. Turns out he blocked me on Twitter. Don't know why, but he blocked me on Twitter, so I can't ask him directly, but I will have to ask him at some point in time. However, even though that particular Australian filmmaker had made a claim of copyright violation, there was another person who did the same thing. 2 years later, in 2012, a woman named Brigitte Bergen claims that the movie was stolen from an unpublished two-part book she had originally written called The Final Call. She claims that she entered 10 chapters of her book into a nationally advertised writing contest conducted by the Writer's Digest and the Peter Taylor Prize in Tennessee. She claims that numerous screeners or readers who were able to read the manuscripts and submissions were then allowed to take them home and keep them after the completion of the contest. Her lawsuit claimed that two of these screeners, who were supposedly judges, were actually Gary Whitta and somebody else. But she basically says it was Gary who stole the idea from her and then presented it to the Hughes brothers. According to her lawsuit, she says, "Gary Whitta was one of the first recipients to receive the manuscript and present it to Alan and Albert, the Hughes brothers, to produce and direct. And yet, unnamed sources who paid Whitta to replicate the manuscript's last remaining chapters in the form of a screenplay, which he named The Book of Eli." And of course, there's been nothing to finish that up as well. Nothing has come from it, but this kind of thing happens all the time. If you, as a quick aside, if you ever want to look up the woman Sophia Stewart and her claims about The Matrix and Terminator, that's a wild, wild story. I've actually spoken to her once for about 90 minutes. And our conversation was definitely something that was, oh boy, really crazy. And I'll have to talk about that in another episode. But look, to wrap things up, I love this movie. I think as a person who doesn't have faith, it really does kind of command a lot of that from the viewer who's watching. You are led to believe that faith exists in this particular world and that there is a higher benevolent being that is omnipotent and has the ability to protect those who, like, impervious to what? Like hunger, to disease, to bullets, to damage, in order to carry out the mission at hand. And that is something that I wouldn't mind seeing explored in, like, maybe a sequel or another interpretation of this particular story. Because as we saw at the end of the movie, there was more books, the Torah, the Quran, and others, leading me to believe that there were other people that were sent to Alcatraz as a way to be kind of almost like prophets on this front. And then were they also protected? That is something that I'm kind of curious about. It almost feels to me like a bit of Stephen King's The Stand. Elements of it are kind of at play here. And there's elements I'd like to know more about. But it also doesn't demand that of me when the movie is over. When the movie is over, I'm like, yeah, I had fun. It was good. I can't wait to talk about this. And of course, I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say about this. So if you enjoy or don't like The Book of Eli, I do want to hear your thoughts. Let me know on Twitter at Patio Commentary, or leave a review on iTunes if you guys want. Head on over to patreon.com/Matt Jarboe to support the channel, support the podcast, and help me keep this thing going to talk about movies for literally the rest of my life. I'll talk to you guys next week when we dive into the 2006 horror video game movie Silent Hill. And of course, after that, Valentine's Day, we're going to be talking about 1980s classic My Bloody Valentine. My name is Matt Jarboe. Have yourself a great day, everybody. Thank you again for listening, and peace out.